This episode of Developing Courage is brought to you by Minds in Motion. If you and your family are struggling with the development of one or more children, find out about their four-quadrant program for kids K-12 at mimlearning.com.
Welcome back to Developing Courage. I am Lauren Thomas.
I'm Kara Vonderheide.
And today in the studio, we have Dr. Jennifer Kimes. Jenny is a colleague of mine through First Steps, the early intervention program here in Kentucky. She is the director of education at Down Syndrome of Louisville, but she is also a psychologist by training. And we are having Jenny in because Jenny has a daughter with Down syndrome and autism, so she is diagnosed with both. So we are really excited to get her parent perspective on raising a child with both of these diagnoses.
Yeah, a lot of parents that we see on a daily basis have more than one thing to focus on, don't they? So it'll be good to hear how to juggle that and how to manage that from Jenny, and what kind of parenting things that are extra that you think about in that scenario.
Yeah, Jenny has done a ton of research and has done a lot of traditional therapies, but also a lot of more alternative things for her daughter. And it'll be really interesting to hear what she feels has really made a big difference for her. Enjoy the show.
We'd like to give a special thank you to Minds in Motion and Candace Meyer for sponsorship of this episode. Minds in Motion is a buzzing place around the summertime. Lots and lots of camps going on, lots of individual sessions where kids are coming in to work on their functional skills, primarily through stimulating the vestibular system. We'd like to let you know that you can go to mimlearning.com, or you can call Minds in Motion. Through the summer, they will have a location in Louisville, Kentucky, and Carmel, Indiana. After starting in the fall, they'll just be focusing on their Louisville location only. You can give them a call and let them know that we gave you the podcast or the promotional code podcast, and they will give you $100 off an assessment when you first go to see them. So check them out, Minds in Motion. Thank you.
Okay, so we have Dr. Jennifer Kimes in the studio today, but we are really here to talk to her as a parent. She just is a psychologist by training, so she may pull some of that into this interview. So welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So Jenny, tell me a little bit about your background and your daughter and kind of your story.
Okay. Well, I'll start with how Tabby, before she got here, I was actually a teacher. I was a preschool teacher. My undergraduate degrees are in early childhood and elementary education. And I got a master's in counseling psych and then realized you can't do a lot with a master's in counseling psych. So I kept going to school. That brought me here to Louisville, Kentucky, to work on my PsyD degree at Spalding. So I was probably 90% through of my graduate program, working on my psychology degree, and I became pregnant with Tabby, and that's when kind of my career path, took a new turn. It's been great what I do because I can merge both my education background and the psychology training, and then being a parent on top of that has really helped connect to other families of children with all developmental disabilities, but especially Down syndrome. And but a little bit about, my diagnosis with Tabitha. I was actually, she was diagnosed prenatally with Down syndrome. We went in for our first ultrasound, about 16 weeks, I guess, and nothing greatly alarming, but they did notice an abnormality. I think it was called a choreoplexus cyst was on her brain, and very common abnormality. You or I could have had them, but they typically resolve. But at my OBGYN practice, they send all abnormalities on to the specialist. And so we went on for further testing, and the specialist thought it might have been trisomy 18 or trisomy 21, which is Down syndrome. And I didn't know anything about either, but doing some preliminary research, I discovered trisomy 18 is terminal, and most babies don't live beyond a few weeks or months. And so I went on to have an amniocentesis just to know whether, you know, even to prepare myself to be a mom. At that point, we had decided to keep the pregnancy because I was so excited to be a mom, and we were just praying it was trisomy 21. So went on, you know, for some of that genetic testing and did, in fact, find out it was not trisomy 18. It was trisomy 21. And we're very excited, but also still didn't know a ton about Down syndrome. So started doing some research at the library and found lots of outdated, depressing information. But quickly connected with our local group, Down Syndrome of Louisville. There was actually a friend of a friend who had a baby. He was less than a year, and threw me a baby shower before Tabby got here and invited other moms of children with Down syndrome to participate in that. And so it was really nice to connect with some other moms early on, even before Tabby got here. A little bit overwhelming. I remember crying all the way home from the baby shower and saying, "You're a great bunch of people, but really wish I didn't have to know you." You know, so sometimes I have to temper my enthusiasm when we meet new families because I remember being there. You know, I'm trying to stay very positive and congratulatory on their expected baby, but also realize this is not where they would choose to be if all was said and done. So that's in a nutshell kind of how she came to be.
So Tabby is how old now?
She is now 15 and a half.
Okay, just to give our listeners some perspective on when you were doing your research, this was 16 years ago.
I was wondering that myself when you said about the outdated research and the books you found at the library.
Yes, they were mostly written in the 60s and 70s and weren't too promising and optimistic. But once I got my hands on some current information, which came from Down Syndrome of Louisville, just really put things in perspective, and I had a much more hopeful, optimistic outlook. I also, when I was interviewing pediatricians before she was born, I went to Dr. Lahocki's office, and he was very welcoming and congratulatory and introduced me to the young man who works in his office. And he was very verbal, articulate, very social. And I remember walking out of his office saying, "It's going to be okay. I can do this. You know, if Tabby is anything like this young man, we're going to be all right." And so, when she was born, it was nothing but a joyous occasion. I personally enjoyed knowing prenatally because I could kind of get my ducks in a row, do some research. I'm the weirdo mom who tried to make a referral at First Steps before Tabby was born. So the intake worker was like, "Ma'am, we can't take a referral on a fetus."
That's proactive.
Yes.
So that's kind of me. I like to have a plan, you know, and all the planning I do, it usually goes out the window. But so her birth was just pure joy. And I did not have some of the experiences that mothers describe where they don't know until the birth, finding out that their child has Down syndrome. It was quite amusing, actually, because the genetic specialist who came in to break the news to us, I don't know that he didn't read our file or what, but he was really kind of fumbling over his words and trying to describe all of her physical characteristics and said, you know, "This is really indicative of Down syndrome." And I looked at him and I said, "Well, I sure hope so, because she has Down syndrome." You know, or I would expect that because she has Down syndrome. So
Did she have any of the medical issues associated with Down syndrome?
No major things at birth. We actually had the fetal echocardiogram. I can't remember how far into the pregnancy, but that was one thing we wanted to find out if, you know, because that's such a high incidence for children with Down syndrome, 50%. So we had the rule out, you know, early on that her heart looked good. And at birth, she did have a very high bilirubin count. I delivered at Baptist East over on Browns Lane, and they debated about even taking her to Cozair, but you know, she had a transfusion and her bilirubin count came down. And so I roomed in for about a week, which was nice because I got to use the industrial breast pump, you know. Mm-hmm. And but it was good. I guess they had several rooms that were open, so they let me stay there for the whole week that she was admitted to the hospital. And so that was it at the beginning. She's had some gastrointestinal things. She does have, she's farsighted, so she's been wearing glasses since she was about two. She has a mild hearing loss. She didn't pass her newborn hearing screening, and we went, you know, jumping through the ABR hearing screening hoops and the tubes and all that. And so she does continue to have a mild hearing loss in one ear. And so that's the major health things that she's faced. And then, you know, when she was about 8 or 9, it kind of dawned on me, came to the realization or the acceptance, really, that she probably has autism as well. So I can talk a little bit about just her early development and then kind of what showed up and our struggles.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious that it was 8 or 9 that you picked up that she might also have this dual diagnosis of autism,
yes.
Which I know from working with you mm-hmm. that is actually becoming a more common thing, mm-hmm. that Down syndrome and autism are dually diagnosed.
Yes.
So what, looking back at 8 or 9, she gets diagnosed. Looking back, were there things that you said, oh, okay, mm-hmm. this makes sense.
Yes, yes. Well, and it is higher in the Down syndrome population. It's about 10 to 15% of people with Down syndrome also have autism, which makes you go, what are those shared characteristics? Why is that even higher than the typical population? Although what we've seen is in the typical population, as that rate has gone up exponentially, by the way, you know, so has ours in the Down syndrome population. So it's really interesting to see. But Tabby was doing very, very well, probably for her first 2.5-3 years of development, just quite the rock star, I must say, and very engaged, followed directions, you know, matching and sorting and just showing off for other people.
Did you get home from the hospital and you called First Steps back?
Yes, I did.
That, okay,
yes,
so she's
did.
Having services through
yes,
this time.
Yes,
okay.
She's getting lots of great services. And we lived here in the Louisville area at the time, but she was getting weekly OT, weekly PT, weekly speech, twice weekly DI services. So
developmental intervention.
Yes.
For
yes.
those who need a glossary.
Yes. but yes, she was doing very, very well. Then we ended up moving. I had to do my internship for my doctoral program, and we moved to Eastern Kentucky. And she entered childcare. She'd never been in childcare until that point. So she entered childcare. We saw a few little things, you know, teachers were saying she's kind of hiding in the corner and not really social and fussing and crying and not wanting to be with us. And I thought, well, that's not my Tabby, but Tabby never been in structured childcare.
How old is she at that point?
About 3.
Okay.
Yeah. And plus First Steps had ended. So I thought, well, you know, we paid for some outpatient speech and developmental intervention to come to the home and to the child care center. So the other kind of thing that happened is I became pregnant with our second daughter. So we have new sister, new house, new child care. She's showing some behaviors. I'm kind of chalking it up to, gosh, this poor little girl has lots of transitions, lots of adjustments to make. And then we experienced that chronic illness that happens in child care. So she was becoming, you know, getting sinus infections, ear infections once a month at least. We were on an antibiotic probably every 3 weeks.
Wow.
And my husband worked and I worked. And so it was like, you know, get the fever down for 24 hours so you can ship him back to school because you got to be back to work. So she was sick quite a bit. She was sick for probably that first 6 months, I think, which she had not really been sick before when she was a stay-at-home little one. So, yeah, I'd noticed her skills. She regressed somewhat, but she really wasn't progressing. You know, like going out trick-or-treating, that was not happening. She was starting to do more, I wouldn't say stimming at that point yet, but really more focused time. She really focused in on, you know, TV or whatever, the computer, and transitions were really hard for her. So I didn't think much about it. You know, we were thinking, you know, it's vision, it's hearing, it's sensory. I mean, that was the big thing at the time, you know, 13 years ago was, oh, wow, her sensory system's way out of whack. Yes, she has major sensory seeking and some sensory aversions. And so I'm thinking she's just got a lot. She's a very complex child with Down syndrome. We ended up moving back to Louisville because there was a job opening at Down Syndrome of Louisville, and we were ready to come back. That 2 years in Eastern Kentucky was, I loved the area and the people were wonderful, but there weren't a lot of support services. And we went to a couple of regional meetings for parents, and we were the only ones who came, like 2-3 times in a row, and said, well, we're not going to get a lot of parent support and networking if we're the only parents here.
Right.
And you never saw, we would go out frequently, but we never the whole time we're in that community, never saw another child with Down syndrome out in the stores or restaurants. And so we know they're there. It just wasn't, I think, as accepted in mainstream as it is, you know, in a more urban area. So, yeah, there were days I was crying going, I need to get back to Louisville. I need to get back to my support system. So we came back to Louisville. And
how old was Tabby at that time?
She was about four.
Okay.
Yes. Four, almost five. We started the preschool system. She's still having adjustments, a lot of behavior issues, melting down, you know, refusal, scratching, pinching at transitions and in large areas, melting down, especially, you know, during assemblies and things like that. And at that time, too, speech therapist said, well, I'm wondering if she might have apraxia. Her language still isn't coming. It still isn't coming. She's having inconsistent sounds and vocal productions for words. And so apraxia is very common with children with Down syndrome. It's that motor planning of language. And we did notice a discrepancy between her receptive language and her expressive language. And I'd say at about five or six, she still only had maybe six words and struggling with saying the same words. You know, over and over again, it would come out differently every time she would say it. So,
and then I think you start to hear people say, well, she's not talking. So some of this behavior stuff is she doesn't have the words.
Right.
So you're seeing behavior.
Right. She's just frustrated.
She's just frustrated.
Did she use any other sort of communication system?
We did sign. We did sign language early on, and she took to that pretty well. I would say she was taken to it rapidly in those first 3 years and started using it less and less. She would gesture, but getting her to really communicate, having that interpersonal communication was challenging. She would sign if she really, really wanted something. We'd have to do a lot of sabotage and withholding. But there wasn't a lot of conversing between us going on, even at a nonverbal level. So we did have her assessed outpatient, and they said, yep, she's got apraxia.
As parents, we focus on the day-to-day development and well-being of our children. Minds in Motion can be your partner in struggles with hyperactivity, homework, frequent meltdowns, frustration, and other situations that are keeping your family from thriving. Get to mimlearning.com to read 10 signs of struggle and sign up to learn about their four-quadrant program for kids K through 12. Minds in Motion has locations in Louisville, Kentucky, and Carmel, Indiana. If your family is struggling with development of one or more children, contact Minds in Motion and start solving the problems today. MIMLearning.com.
So this whole time I'm thinking, you know, from the time she was assessed with apraxia until it kind of dawned on me, wow, this looks more like autism. I'm thinking she's got sensory issues and apraxia and hearing loss and vision issues. And, you know, she's just not like the other kids. And we probably stayed away from even some of the events for children with Down syndrome because I'm going, she's not quite like those other kids with Down syndrome. And then I started working more with children with autism through my independent work with First Steps. And it's interesting because at first it was really the non-diagnostic criteria issues that I saw with other children with Tabby. Oh, this gastrointestinal stuff and the food stuff. I think the biggest thing really that when I look back that was a big red flag for me is Tabby stopped chewing food. She went from being an incredibly good eater, meats, crunchies, anything, no texture versions. I mean, you put anything in front of the child, she'd eat it, and the spicier the better, to she would stop crunching. She used to love chips. No longer would she bite a chip. Used to love crackers. No longer biting crackers. So anything she could kind of mash and get down her throat. But I thought, not chewing is not a typical, you know, regression for children with Down syndrome. So I went to the dentist, ruled out anything with her teeth. The dentist says, nope, they look great. I don't see any issues. She should be able to eat and chew fine. So finally I said, okay, this is beyond, you know, the typical developmental profile of a child with Down syndrome. There's something else going on here. So things like that, the eating and the gastrointestinal stuff, the sleeping, her sleep. She'd always had trouble sleeping. We had the sleep study, and we had her tonsils and adenoids out. That helped tremendously. Even at one point when she was about 6 years old, I thought, she's so hyper and so hard to engage and focus. Maybe it's ADHD. I mean, we'd ruled out thyroid, which is very common with Down syndrome. Wasn't hyperthyroid. You know, I was kind of hoping for hyperthyroid. I know how to deal with that. So it wasn't hyper, wasn't hypo. But the pediatrician was gracious enough to say, well, let's do a trial, you know, medication for ADHD. Didn't help because, you know, shouldn't have ADHD. So we thought, well, maybe sleep apnea. And we did get tonsils and adenoids out. That helped tremendously. She snored like a lumberjack before and after, you know, not so much. She's much more engageable. Not the ideal situation, but better. So again, you know, I'm kind of chalking all of this stuff up, you know, before she's eight to all these other issues. But finally, at age eight, when we had this issue with she's not chewing, her actual feeding is regressing. There's something else here. And working with typically, I just call them typically developing children with autism, but just singly diagnosed children with autism, started seeing more similarities between Tabitha with the autism population than with the Down syndrome population. And I had some moments, you know, and said, okay, well, now that we know, let's move on to this new world of what this morphism, you know, of Down syndrome and autism looks like. And Tabby fits pretty well into that subpopulation.
So did you have her officially tested for autism, or did you just put on your psychology hat and kind of come to that conclusion for her?
Yeah, I put on my psychology hat and kind of did that. You know, up in Cincinnati, the Children's Hospital, there's a Thomas Center affiliated with that, and they do quite a bit of testing for children. We just haven't taken her up there. And here, you know, amongst my colleagues and psychologists, they don't work with a lot of children with Down syndrome. So I've had a lot of psychologists contact me when they have a child with Down syndrome, walk in the door and go, hey, I've got this referral for this. What do you think? So I was kind of coaching them along. And so I've just, as a mom, said, yeah, this looks like autism. And we haven't needed to. I said, if we ever officially needed that for whatever services or programs, we'll go ahead and get that official diagnosis on her, you know, slapped on there too. But yeah, I've just sort of mommy psychologist diagnosed her. Yeah.
So what are some of the things, you know, I feel like in our world, everything now is supposed to be evidence-based and you need to have research behind anything, just about anything that you try. I guess, you know, what is your feeling both as a psychologist and a mom on how to balance that information? Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, as clinicians, we know too that sometimes things that are evidence-based, sometimes they don't work for people and sometimes other things work better. So
right.
How did you kind of balance that information, being a person who had access to all the evidence-based stuff, but kind of going with your gut as a mom too?
Yeah. And it's really interesting how I've come full circle on that, because I started working with families whose children had been diagnosed with autism, coming in as the psychologist who was going to do some ABA therapies. So some intensive applied behavioral analysis, strictly behavioral. And the families were telling me about this new diet stuff that they're trying. They were seeing specialized doctors who are talking about gluten and casein-free diet and vitamin supplementation. And in the back of my mind, I'm going, these poor parents are just in denial, right? You know, they're just, yeah, it's all about the behavioral therapies. We're just going to address the symptoms, right? And I was like, well, whatever, you know. Wackadoo. So it's really funny that now I'm that parent, you know, and trying to, you know, use some of the same strategies. So what I was seeing as a psychologist working, you know, strictly with the ABA approach, children were making progress, but it was very intensive and very lengthy and so much work involved. But when I was working with the children who were on some non-traditional interventions, whether it was dietary, nutrition, supplementation, children were making more rapid progress. So for the families who weren't doing that, I would say, hey, I have this other family that's trying this. Why don't you know, talk to or do some reading or talk to your pediatrician or talk to your pharmacist or, you know, kind of pointing them in that direction. And then more and more children I was working with, I started seeing changes. I'm going, wow, this stuff's really fascinating. I want to dive into that. And partially through that and my own child, that's how it all kind of merged together and doing some reading. And there was a good book. It's been controversial, but Unraveling the Mystery of Pervasive Developmental Disorder and autism, but it has a great layman's description of the gluten casein-free diet and what it does. And that was sort of the opening for me. It was like, wow, that really opened the door to understanding that sounds like Tabitha. This sounds like that child. This sounds like this child. And what the parents were doing and why they were getting better. And then that led to another book and another book and another book. Some of my favorites are Jacqueline McCandless or McChandless has a book called Children with Starving Brains. And she's actually a medical provider. She's a pediatrician whose granddaughter was diagnosed on the spectrum. And so she started doing, I loved anything that was medically based because I still have one foot in that, in that community. I was like, show me the science behind it. It's not just, you know, a Hollywood success story of someone with a child with autism. I wanted to know the science behind it. And that's where I started to have to balance, you know, the evidence-based behavioral therapies are fantastic, but you get more bang for your buck if they're coupled with something. You know, often that's what I was seeing. And so for parents to have access to that information and try it, you know, I haven't read anything that says it could be detrimental as long as children are getting all the nutrients they need on some of those diets. That's not going to hurt them,
right?
You know, to try it. And some families do try it and don't find the success that they're looking for, but it's worth a try. And it's so much, I think, more, honestly, more affordable than 40 hours a week of therapeutic services when you can do a diet modification, and see powerful change. Plus, I'm a big proponent of let's not just address the symptom, let's address the issue. Why is this happening to children? And there's still a lot of different theories and reasons why. But I'm, as a parent, convinced that there's some interplay between what's happening inside of children and what's happened outside. And if we can go back and address that. And I've done a lot of reading and hooked up with a local pharmacist who does integrative medicine and talked about, you know, how we metabolize nutrients and what we children with autism don't process and the nutritional deficiencies they experience. And so in addition to the gluten casein-free diet for Tabitha, we are also doing a pretty comprehensive you know, nutritional supplementation. And looking at children with Down syndrome and autism, they share a lot of those same nutritional deficiencies. So for me, it's no surprise why there's an increase in the rate of autism in that population when they're naturally susceptible to that anyway.
Right. Well, especially since some of the first indicators you said were revolving around gastrointestinal and feeding, mm-hmm. it would make sense as a parent mm-hmm. that you would continue to pursue that along with the behavioral management stuff. Can you explain in just a few minutes a little bit more about the ABA approach, just so people out there have kind of a good picture of what that behavior piece looks like?
Sure. It can be very intensive. I combine ABA with some floor time strategies too, depending on what the goal was and the child and their mood. But that ABA is, I think the hallmark is that discrete trial method. And so sitting down with a child, and I tend to be a most to least prompter. So if you want the child to follow a direction like put the block in the bucket, you know, it's repetitive. It has a reward system after every trial initially, and then you fade your reward. But it's pretty intensive. And then once the child has mastered that task, then you work on kind of generalizing or shaping that into a more complex task. But that can take time. And sometimes you can work for an hour, days, weeks on the same discrete skill. And it can become kind of frustrating for families when they don't see a lot of progress, or they don't see the progress that they want as rapidly as they would like.
Right. And it would make sense before you went into that intensive situation that you would want, as you described it, their insides or their body, you know, to have as much readiness for that as possible.
Absolutely. That's what I was seeing with the children who were doing some of the dietary modifications and the nutrition supplementation is children were more engageable. They were following directions with fewer prompts. They were making more eye contact. They were smiling. They were learning at a faster rate. They were generalizing skills more quickly. And plus all of the kind of non-diagnostic stuff from the DSM-5 that's not in there, like, oh, wow, they're eating more than three things. They ate bologna and pickles instead of just pasta, cereal, and crackers. So that was one thing I saw is when children were getting some of those toxins out of their body and getting some of that gluten out of their system is they were now opening up to other foods, random foods. It wasn't any predictable. Every child was so different. But it's like, yes, we're seeing this. We're seeing, and bowel functioning was improving, and bloating was going down, and sleeping was improving. And so all these things that aren't necessarily diagnostic criteria of autism, but what I was seeing in probably 85% of the families I worked with, it's all improving. You know, we're just healing from the inside out.
So with Tabby, when you started to make these changes, when you went from, when you became the wackadoo mom, as you like to say.
Self-proclaimed, yes.
Yes. When you started to institute some of these gluten-free, casein-free nutritional things for her, how long do you feel like it took for you to go, this is really making a difference for her?
Right. I think for Tabitha, it was probably about 10 days. And that's, what I tell families when I work with them, I say, you know, some families have said 3 days they start seeing progress. Some families 3 weeks, 3 months. You know, they say to give it a good 6 months because you've really got to get all that out of their system. And it's so embedded into everything. Some children cannot have any breaches in their diet. Parents will say they had a half of a cookie and were off the wall. It was like the old Johnny came back for like a day. So Tabitha can have a few breaches here and there, but we can't fall off the wagon for too long. You know, she has Domino's pizza and then like one other thing on a weekend, we're paying the price the next week. She's bloated, she's crabby, she's not happy. But
that might be anybody who eats a Domino's pizza. Right? I'm just right. Totally kidding. Yeah. Domino's is going to be calling.
Yeah. That's right.
So probably probably 10 days, I started noticing an improvement. She started following directions more. She, you could tell her to do something one time and she'd do it. She became more conversational. I could ask her about her day and it might've been just a yes, no, but it was accurate and it wasn't a, don't talk to me, don't look at me kind of thing. It was, yes, I'm responding to you. One of the things that we started to do that we saw the most immediate result was, glutathione. Sorry, I just lost it there for a minute. Glutathione, which is a supplement. I was thinking of the brand name that we use. But glutathione helps you absorb all your other nutrients. So I will say, as a parent, we did some nutritional supplementation before I learned, oh, wait, if you don't have the mechanisms to actually absorb all those nutrients, you're literally just pissing them away.
Yeah.
I mean, so I kicked myself for the couple years that we did all that, you know, before we realized, maybe if she has the absorption mechanisms to absorb all that good stuff that we were pumping into her, she'd do better. So we started on some glutathione, and within 24 hours, we saw improvement. Usually Tabby'd wake up in the morning and just stay in her room and stim until we forced her to come out. And the very next morning, she actually woke us up. She threw, the bedroom door open and walked in bright-eyed, bushy-tailed and said, "Good morning, Daddy." And I sat up in bed and started to cry. I was like, oh, my goodness, this
Absolutely.
Is so profound, so profound. Some of the other things that we saw after learning what to look for were Tabitha used to have these beautiful crystal blue eyes. And early in childhood, probably, around 4 or 5, they just became a little more gray, a little more dark, and almost black, I would say, looking into her eyes when she would establish eye contact. They were kind of black. When we started on the glutathione, her eyes were blue again. And what I learned is that the pupils dilate when you're under oxidative stress. And so I started noticing that with the children I work with who are on the spectrum is, wow, they all have these dark eyes. But then once we started talking about antioxidants and glutathione, can do that, their eye color, parents were saying, their eyes are so much better. I have a little one I'm working with right now. And to look at her after the family's done some of these interventions and say, well, there you go, crystal blue eyes. And she's looking at you with clarity and not through you anymore. And it's just nice to see her connected. So that was the other thing that we
that's fascinating.
How about that?
Amazing. Yeah, how about that? What about her feeding? How did you see that improve with some of this?
She's still not big on a lot of the crunchies that she used to, but she that improved tremendously. Yeah, she now will eat her corn chips, like she used to. But I wish that was back to where it was. She's still a little hesitant with the deep crunchy things.
So fast forward to today.
Yes.
Let's talk about what Tabby's up to now. So she's 15.
She's 15.
She's in school.
She's a freshman in high school. Yes.
And yeah. How's everything going?
Well, it's going pretty well. She loves school. You know, not always happy to wake up, but happy to get on the bus. She never fights us. So that was a change. You know, we knew she liked her old school, but it was a battle. Every transition was a battle. It was so exhausting as a parent to be like, you know, fight a battle to get out of bed, fight a battle to get dressed, fight a battle to get downstairs, fight a battle to get in the bus, everything. So now just getting up, which I don't blame her because I'm not a morning person either. So we do a nice smooth transition to wake up. We snuggle and kind of tickle and make her happy. And then, but she's following directions and happy to go to school. And she talks about friends, which is great. Her language is still pretty delayed, but at least she's much more conversational. She'll throw out a topic, and I'll ask her some simple questions about it, and she'll give me an answer. And then we might even have three or four back and forth cycles of that. She's starting to play games with the family that she never did before. But now, you know, a couple times a week, I might get her to sit down and play a game, you know, Ants in the Pants or Duck, Duck, Goose or sometimes she even initiates. She'll say puzzle, and doing a puzzle with her before was horrible. Even using my nice ABA stuff, it was full hand over hand assistance. It was full resistance for every piece. It was throwing and tantruming. And now she requests periodically, but to do a puzzle. She initiated a tag game with one of her siblings, just went up to him and said, "Alex, tag," and then ran off. And I was like, that never happened in the years before. So my only regret is that maybe I was clued into the symptoms earlier and started earlier, because we really didn't. It was a total evolution. I tell parents, you can't just one day say, you know, get rid of everything in your fridge, get rid of everything in your cabinets, and just start all this at one day. It's truly been an evolution of adding this, taking away that, adding this, taking away that. But I wish we had started sooner, you know, at 2 or 3 years old versus 8 or 9.
So is this a family affair? Is everyone in the house gluten-free and casein-free?
No, not everyone. I do some things that are parallel. So if we have spaghetti, then I make her gluten-free spaghetti. That was one of my fears as a working parent, full-time working parent, is I'm going to have to quit my job and stay home and bake bread all day. And, you know, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do this? But there's so much commercially available now. And thankfully for the freezer, you know, I make things in bulk and freeze them. So if the other kids, you know, get an Eggo waffle, which they don't anymore because I've fallen off that cliff of health food. But, you know, if the other kids get a frozen waffle, then she gets her frozen waffle. Or I make a batch of cupcakes, gluten-free cupcakes, and freeze them. And then when we have birthday cake, I pull out one for her. So sometimes I'll do things in parallel, although we have become much more aware. And I must say we have reduced the amount of just overall, I think, carbs in our home. We're eating much more health conscious. I started juicing. You know, we're really, I think as a family, more aware of what we're eating. And now we have a 2-year-old who came along after we started some of this dietary intervention. And so, you know, learning about autism and having a newborn baby, I was going to try to do everything proactively. I said, I don't know if he's going to have autism. We don't know, but I'm going to know everything that I've read that parents say after the fact they wish they would have changed. Like, we washed all of his things in natural soap. He didn't get any cow's milk. He did rice, almond milk, and toddler formula. He did no gluten for the first year. Now he's on a low-gluten diet. So, yeah, we've tried to make some changes for him.
Do you feel like your medical professionals that you've run into during all of these years, when you're experimenting with all of these changes, do you feel like they gave you extra leeway, knowing that you were a psychologist and, you know, kind of had a good handle on things? Or did they think of you as wacky mom too?
Yeah, I think I got a little bit of both. I have a good relationship with our pediatrician. So when I told her that we were doing the gluten-free diet, she was like, well, I don't really believe in all that. Although I'm an athlete seasonally, and I'll do gluten-free because it makes me feel good. But And I'm like, yeah, so you acknowledge that it's helpful, but maybe not a treatment mechanism, you know, for my child. But so they're like, you know, it's not going to hurt her as long as she's getting all the nutrients that she needs. And that's my thing. You know, we do a lot of supplementation to make sure she's not lacking anything that she needs. But because we've had lots of conversations about the immunizations. You know, we've done immunizations, but, you know, we've maybe done a delayed schedule, or we've just done them a little judiciously, or tried to, you know, if they have available at the pediatrician, to not have the combined, you know, to do the separate, just in case. I'm not saying there's, you know, but I would hate as a parent looking back and say, oh, I wish I would have, you know, I don't want those regrets with the other ones.
Right.
So yeah, we've gotten a little bit of both. I think like the fact that our pediatrician said, sure, we'll try her on a trial of ADHD medication, you know, can't hurt. They gave me more leeway there because they saw her behavior in the office too, I think. But at the same time, they're not ready to change their standard practice, you know, their care and their policies. So
do you send food in with her to school?
We do.
Mm-hmm. And has the school been responsive to that and respecting your dietary wishes?
It has ebbed and flowed. In elementary and middle, it was better. Now in high school, she does a cooking class and a food class. So she's making some products, and I know there's gluten in them. Usually they come home in her lunchbox, and we go, oh, great, you made that. And we kind of hide it and then pitch it. Yeah. That's fantastic. And I think there's still a lot of education to be done. People are like, gluten, what's that?
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah, so just educating people on what it is and why she can't have it. You know, the people who've been most on board are the ones who see the change, who've said, and that was another thing that we did when she was in elementary school and we started some of the supplementation. We didn't tell the teachers, not to be mean or critical, but I wanted to know that other people were seeing change. So when they came to us and said, you know, Tabby's doing really well. She's attending. She's focused. She's interactive. She's not, you know, fighting us at every transition. And this is great. She's made a lot of progress. Those therapies are really helpful. And I'll say, yes, they are.
You just nod and smile.
Yes. But that's it. I believe in the therapies. I just think they're even more effective, you know, if the child's internally ready and, and responding. So, yeah.
Okay, Jenny, I do want to ask you, as a mom, so you knew before Tabby was born that she had Down syndrome, and you had kind of come to understand that diagnosis and what it might mean for your family. At 8 or 9, when she got diagnosed with autism also, talk a little bit about how your emotions were at that point with a double diagnosis, because I know it's really hard for some of the families we work with to even handle one diagnosis and kind of process that.
It is, absolutely. And even before that diagnosis, I remember having a moment or two when she was officially diagnosed with her hearing loss. We'd gone through all these ABRs and finally said, yep, she definitely has a established hearing loss. And for some reason, that was really, they were talking about hearing aids and all this. That was very hard. It was like the straw that broke the camel's back. And I remember at that point just being like, what else can go on? So a few years, you know, fast forward a few years, and there was this whole autism thing. It's been really, I think, because I've had this nagging feeling all along that something wasn't right. But yeah, I remember reading, going, this is my child, reading about autism, going, this is Tabby, and struggling with that, you know, having some good cries, shedding a few tears. And it's hard, especially with this population, to have the dual diagnosis. There's not a lot of us out there, and we've almost feel isolated from both communities. Our child is not quite like a child with autism, so going to some of the autism support functions, you know, we're a little bit of an outsider, and then our child's not fully like a child with Down syndrome, so we feel like a little bit of outcast there. So we've actually formed our own parent support network, and we meet every other month at Down Syndrome of Louisville of the dually diagnosed children, so we can just sort of share that experience, because that is so hard. To have yet another, it's like, does this child have to go through this again? And probably in the last 5 years, I've shed more tears over the autism diagnosis than the Down syndrome. We've had a few days here and there where she has really presented more like a typically developing child with Down syndrome, you know, more like a child with Down syndrome. And I've gone, yes, this must be what it's like, and just celebrated. And then, you know, we'll have then bad days following that. And you know, those are the hard times when you grieve that, and I think just kind of, I'm a very spiritual person. My husband's a pastor. Just in the last few years, he went back to school to seminary and has become a pastor. And so that, I've always been a spiritual person, however, but that's helped me cope quite a bit, to say there is a plan and a purpose in all this. And we just have to help each other and we'll get through this. And Tabby's happy. She thinks she's a rock star. She thinks she's prom queen. Our community has been so supportive. At school, I go to pick her up and everybody's, bye, Tabby, you know, and she's like, whatever, peeps, you know. And, that's my big thing is she's healthy, she's happy, and you can ask for more than that. I will say for other parents, though, who grieve the loss of what might not be, a couple things that have really helped me is to celebrate the things that the hard things about life that she may not have to experience. You know, I'm fairly certain that Tabby will not have to experience, some addictions. I flippantly, and you can edit this if you want, I flippantly said, I don't have to worry that she's going to be on 4th Street like a crack whore, you know, selling her body. I mean, I'm fairly certain she's not going to, that's not going to be her path. You know, can't guarantee that for my other daughter, but, so I have to look at those positives, even in the midst of a dual diagnosis.
Yeah, I think I tell families a lot that, you know, sometimes you have to, if you back up and think about their child doesn't know any differently, mm-hmm. and this is their normal, mm-hmm. and look how happy they are.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing great. And yeah. I think that that has really, you know, it helps calm some of the anxiety.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to be quite a perfectionist and wanted to be in control, obviously making a referral to First Steps before I had the baby. I was like, I need to be in control of this situation. I've really changed my personality to say, it is just ride the wave. You don't have to control the wave. Just ride the wave, enjoy, let it go. She's happy and healthy, and you don't have to be perfect. Maybe our world is the system that isn't quite functioning the way it should be, and not our special children.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Well, thanks so much for being here today. We have started a new game show part of our programming. It's
great.
Called
Surprise.
Name That Vestibular Apparatus.
It's the Minds in Motion Name That Vestibular Apparatus Show.
So what's going to happen is I'm going to give Jenny some hints.
Oh, please.
And she's going to be able to take a guess, but the true answer will be revealed on our Facebook page when the podcast is released.
Great.
So are you ready, Jenny? She didn't
hope
know this was coming.
I hope so.
Okay. Here we go.
Okay.
Okay. This vestibular apparatus is one of the three small bones in the middle ear. There's more. It is the smallest bone, and it is named this because of its resemblance to a stirrup. Is it the malleus, the stapes, or the incus?
Wait, smallest bone in the middle ear or in the whole body?
Oh, in the whole body. I'm
in the
sorry.
Whole body.
Smallest
That's
bone
a
in the
fun
whole
fact
body.
To know.
Okay, so
fun fact.
Those are your choices.
Wow.
Do you have an answer?
You think I would know this because I think I actually have issues with this, like calcium deposits that break off and flush and swish around in your inner ear from here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have that, like I'm going to puke if I move too fast.
Right.
So you think I would know what's going on with my own inner ear. What were my choices again?
The malleus, the stapes, or the incus?
How about the stapes?
Okay, so that's Jenny's guess. You can tune into our Facebook page and find the answer to the Name That Vestibular Apparatus question of the day.
Thank you, Minds in Motion.
Thank you, Minds in Motion.
Okay, we have one more question that we like to ask everybody who comes in. It's always a fascinating answer. What gives you your courage every day to do what you do?
The Lord, for sure. For sure. I get up. That's the first thing I do before I open my eyes is I pray before I get out of bed. Yep. And I think just trying to be the best mom I can be, despite stressors and sickness and the world. Yeah.
Sounds like you're on a good path with that. I love the answer that you gave before about celebrating.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here.
Say what you want to say.
This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only and should not be construed as therapeutic or medical advice, as your particular situation will vary. If you have concerns, please contact your local healthcare professional. For more information and additional episodes, visit Kara and Lauren online at developingcourage.com. And thanks for listening.